Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Faiths Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernacle. I am your host, Brian Dillman. Before we get talking about the episode today, I want to remind everyone about our fundraiser for the Liahona Children's Foundation. As I am recording this, we have received $3,045 in donations. That's just a hair over 30% of our goal of $10,000. And that is great. That is so exciting. More and more of these perks are coming down or are being claimed by people that are donating. There is only one more of the five books of Jesus available of James Goldberg's. There are a few more Studio C photos. Studio C shirts are gone. So there's a lot of activity here. This is great. I'm really excited to see that happening. So if you haven't already, I'll leave a link in the show notes for this podcast and link you to the Indiegogo page. Go there, donate $20, donate $50. If you want that Tree of Life sculpture and you've got the cash, donate $500 and make a big bump in our goal this week. So please make sure to take the time to look into that. As for the episode today, I had a wonderful discussion with Ben Knoll and Megan Goodwin, who is a religious studies scholar, and we talked about the way that religions are portrayed in media, the way that we talk about them in general, the way that we take legal action against especially minority religions, and it was not only fascinating, but it was challenging because it caused me to rethink the way that I view the morals or the quality or the goodness or the craziness of religions that are different than mine, especially minority ones. So I think that's something that's good for us to do. So let's jump right to it. All right, so we've got another episode here on the Rational Faiths Podcast, and Ben Knoll is back. Ben blogs at Rational Faiths, and he's a professor down at Center College. Say hello, Ben.
Hello.
And we have our specialist for today for the topic is Megan Goodwin. Megan, you gave a lecture at Center College, and Ben thought it was wonderful, and so we've got together. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what your area of expertise is, and what you're up to?
Great. So I work in gender and sexuality in American minority religions, particularly after 1980. The talk I did at Center, which was lovely, it was such a great opportunity, was specifically looking at the ways popular American media portray women in minority religions. So we looked at Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which is a favorite of mine. And I wanted the students at the convocation gathering to think about, yes, it's funny, but what does it do to sort of make fun of women in minority religions, particularly around issues of sexual difference? So there's a sort of plural marriage-esque setup in that family, and it plays on a lot of tropes about cults. And I wanted them to maybe think a little bit harder about what that does. So currently I'm at Bates. I'm on a 2-year Mellon postdoctoral fellowship for creative and innovative pedagogy in the humanities. And past that is anyone's guess for a job market.
You're out fishing, you could say, trying to find something. All right. Well, great. I think this is an interesting topic. Have you read, I'm assuming you would be familiar with Janet Binion?
Oh, yeah. I had Janet here last winter term. I did a speaker series on controversial positions in the study of religion. And Janet was a huge, huge part of my research on FLDS and Mormon fundamentalisms. So she came down and talked to us about plural marriage as the next civil rights frontier. It was wonderful. She's fantastic.
Interesting. Yeah, I read her book, Desert Patriarchy, and it was fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really, really interesting stuff.
And then tell us, Megan, so what connections do you have with the Mormon community and the academic community and such?
Sure. Honestly, studying Mormons and Mormonisms was sort of an accident. I went to UNC because I was really interested in religion and gender and sexuality, and the guy I wound up working with there, Randall Stiers, is fantastic for that. I did not know at the time that Laurie Maffley Kipp would be taking over as chair of the department. And I think it's very hard to get out of UNC doing American religions without having thought critically about LDS and Mormonism broadly. So I'm grateful for that. And obviously, we also have a number of really fantastic people that came through that department. So Jared Anderson, Matt Gray, Travis Proctor's still there. Stan Thane, sorry, still there. John Charles Duffy, number of really great folks that I got to meet while I was working there and have made me think more critically about a religious movement, honestly, that I didn't know very much about when I got to grad school.
Wonderful. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, it kind of, I didn't know when you came to visit that we had that mutual friend of Jared Anderson there that you went to, that you were in the same cohort, right, in graduate school?
Jared was a few years ahead of me.
Oh, okay. But
we actually TA'd together for Archaeology of Ancient Palestine, which is far more his area of expertise than mine.
Oh, nice. Cool.
Yeah. And I'm also a big fan of his wife's work. The photography project, The Mormon Women Bear, I thought was really powerful. And I teach that in my American Minority Religions class. So.
Oh, that's cool stuff. Huh. And so a lot of those names, some people might know if they're really in the academic, keeping up with all the Mormon academics. But just to be clear, Jared Anderson does the Mormon Sunday School podcast that listeners have probably listen to at least a couple episodes, if not all of them. So that's really cool. You've got those connections there. So I want to hear more about this talk that you gave at Center College. Maybe you could give us a short version of that talk. And I do have to say, my wife loved the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Me too.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. No, I...
Crazy. That was it. That was a hit with the students too. That was a good lead-in to talking about this.
Yeah, I was worried, honestly, that the undergrads would not be as psyched about Kimmy Schmidt as I was. I don't know that anybody's actually as psyched about Kimmy Schmidt as I am, but they at least had watched it. So the show obviously it centers on a woman who escapes an apocalyptic new religious movement and makes her way in the city. But I was most interested in sort of the ways that the show portrays membership in a new religious movement, right? So this is the show obviously is portraying an abusive new religious movement. They're rescued by men in flak jackets with SWAT team all over them. And they're very grateful to be rescued. And only one of them actually believed in the movement. Everyone else was forced to be in the movement. The one who believed in the movement was kind of a running joke. And she, when she escapes or when she's pulled really out of the bunker, she goes out and recruits other people. And the reason that I was immediately drawn to the show, in addition to the Tina Fey piece, obviously, was that the women are all visually coded like FLDS women. They have sort of the big pompadour braids. They've got the prairie dresses. They refer to each other as sister, in a pretty kind of heavy-handed alignment with sister wives. And so I was hooked. So what I did was show them some clips and ask them just from the first 2 minutes of the show, how do we know these women are in a cult? And we talked about sort of the visual cues that get used in popular culture. And I used this to think about, all right, we know they're in the cult because they're doing strange things sexually and they are living communally. And the first 2 minutes of the show are showing them being rescued, and we're assuming that they need to be rescued. And so where does this impulse to rescue women in cults come from, and what does it do, right? And I use that to lead into what happened at Yearning for Zion in 2008, where the state government got involved because they had a forced report of abuse happening at the Yearning for Zion Ranch. They went in, they took more than 400 children. It's the largest custodial detention of children in American history. And they did that because they assumed abuse was going on. There's some really damning evidence saying that they aligned the practice of plural marriage with abuse. And this is obviously not to say that abuse doesn't happen in plural marriages. It just, the piece that I'm trying to pull out is that sexual difference doesn't always and everywhere equal abuse, that abuse happens everywhere. And so that we can't assume that all plural marriages everywhere are necessarily abusive and that all women in plural marriages are necessarily being forced or coerced or tricked into being in them. I can go on, but I wanted to be conscientious of the time. Basically, the project is trying to think about the culturally contingent nature of abuse and how things that might look sketchy from the outside wouldn't necessarily be experienced as abuse by people on the inside of that worldview.
Yeah, kind of like a fish has lived in water all its life, but it isn't a fish that discovered the properties of water.
But it's just, again, and John Charles Duffy actually made this point really adroitly, I thought, in his review of Saints Under Siege in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion. If you live in a culture where it's standard for people to get married at 14, 15, 16, and you get married at 14, 15, 16, you're not necessarily going to experience that as abusive. And so that gets into a larger conversation about whether there's universal human rights or universal human values. And can the American mainstream say to, you know, a really isolated culture, well, that is just unilaterally wrong. And I want to, before we move on, underline the fact that when FLDS moved into Texas in 2003, it was still legal for all Texas 14-year-old girls to get married. Across the board. They only raised the age of marriage to 16 because FLDS moved in and they were concerned about it. And they left the age at 16, and this was part of the legal proceedings, specifically because if a girl got married, they wanted to make sure that her parents, or sorry, if a girl got pregnant, they wanted to be sure that her parents could make her get married.
Oh, geez.
There's some tension there between concern about parental or community coercion and then sort of rights to women's bodies.
Mm. In early Mormon history, I'm remembering, you know, polygamy, Joseph Smith comes up, the one 14-year-old bride. I was listening to a discussion with the author Alex Beam, who last year or the year before that wrote a book about the death of Joseph Smith. Mm-hmm. And in that discussion, he pointed out that I think it was Governor Ford of Illinois had a very young wife, younger than 14. And he wasn't bringing that up as like this apologetic saying everything was fine with whatever Joseph Smith was doing, but just as a comparison that there were strange things going on, not necessarily just in the Mormon church. There were strange, what we would consider strange things going on elsewhere as well.
Great. So exactly. That's what my project is looking at, is the sort of disproportionate response to abuse when it happens in a religious context, right? So it's not to say that abuse is ever okay. Obviously it's not. But the American public reacts in a very different way to abuse it assumes or knows is going on in religious contexts, particularly in minority religious contexts, than it does to abuse happening in mainstream households. So sexual abuse of children in particular is rampant throughout the United States. But the American public is largely either ignorant or just sort of exempting itself from having to care about that. Whereas this teeny community with very little political influence, social influence in Texas, warranted not just SWAT teams and police officers, but armored personnel carriers. They sent in tanks to go pick up 400 children. So exactly what I'm trying to get folks to think about is the sort of massive disproportionate nature of mainstream responses to communities that have very little influence and are relatively small. Again, not because we shouldn't be paying attention to abuse, but I'm not sure that the religious piece of that is necessarily the most important piece. And I think we do that honestly because the way that mainstream America thinks about sex has a lot to do with the way that mainstream America thinks about Protestantism. And we tend to respond to non-Protestant forms of religion in these sort of overblown, excessive ways.
That is interesting. That's all really, really cool. So what was most interesting to me when I was attending the thing we had at Center College, and the students, as I talked to them afterwards, is their mind was just blown. Like, they were so used to thinking about, right, the FLDS community as a weird, crazy, small group, right? And I'll admit, even as someone who grew up in kind of mainstream LDS culture, we're also somewhat given that narrative that, oh, those FLDS people are the not good ones. They're the ones who have it all wrong, and they're doing bad stuff that we don't want any association with whatsoever. And so when you have those paradigms of maybe they don't necessarily need to be rescued in all cases, or perhaps it's not always abusive or coercive, like, that was challenging for a lot of the students. And even for me, I mean, that was hitting up against a lot of what I been thinking my whole life about the issue. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure, absolutely. So this is a fraught issue for a lot of people, right? And I want to underline that this sort of impulse to go in and help people we think are in need comes from really great places in us, right? Anne Berline's got this great book called Lift High the Cross, where she talks about sometimes the worst things in us come from the best places in us, where we have these kind of sentimental commitments and we want people to be safe and happy, right? And that's, I think, genuinely the Department of Family Justice in Texas and Children of Yearning for Zion. The problem is we operate from assumptions about what safe and normal looks like that doesn't always make the people in these minority situations feel safe and comfortable. So in Yearning for Zion, I think what the state of Texas wanted was to be sure that children weren't going to be abused. But they assumed that children had to be being abused because they were living in this community, right? All of the literature around this talks about a prevailing belief system that grooms girls to be victims of sexual assault and boys to be future sexual predators. That's in the literature. And that's coming not because they had evidence of extensive sexual assault, although there was some, but because of the belief system in plural marriage, right? All of the conversation and the rhetoric around this kept insisting that it wasn't about religion, but the assumption that it had to be abusive was coming from a deeply theologically rooted belief for Mormon fundamentalists. And so the end result was not FLDS women felt more comfortable reaching out to social services. You know, they had been raised all their lives to think that the government was going to come and take their children, and the government came and took their children. So they further alienated and terrified the community that they were trying to help, which is really unfortunate. I can go on about this for a while.
No, but that's interesting.
One of the things that I thought of, there's this movie that's just been released, The Prophet's Prey.
Oh man, Sam Brower. Yeah. I haven't seen it yet, but I read the book.
Yeah. And I've watched this. It's like an extended trailer. It's called a sizzle reel with highlights and stuff. And you know, Warren Jeffs just seems like an awful.
Oh, he's a horrible human being. Yeah. Absolutely.
And it reminds me of what you were just saying there and recalling this sizzle reel where he made an audio recording of religious sanctioned rape of a 12-year-old girl.
Yep.
And it's horrible. And as you're talking about, you know, maybe they didn't have evidence for abuse, or it was part of their belief system, and that the belief system wasn't necessarily as awful as they had made it out to be. In Utah polygamy, there's a difference between the men, the patriarchs that are high in the hierarchy, and the lay people out farming, you know. Mm-hmm. The prophets, the high-level leadership, tended to have a lot more wives, and they had some of the younger wives, you know, and ridiculous amounts, you know, 20 or more. Mm-hmm. And where the regular, everyday polygamist would have two or maybe three. And so I wonder if this is that similar in what you've studied in these fundamentalist groups, that the leaders have more of what we I think accurately perceive as an abuse of power or an excess of power, and the lay members might have a different experience than what we perceive through coverage of the leaders' behavior.
Exactly. And that honestly was a big issue with what happened for Yearning for Zion. So the panic around Mormon fundamentalism in Texas specifically came because, in large part, Mark Shurtleff, former Attorney General of the state of Utah, and John Krakauer, bless his heart, as we say in the South, and Sam Brower, the author of Prophet's Prey, who was retained as a private investigator to try to bring Warren Jeffs in, went down and told the Texas House of Representatives how very, very bad and dangerous Mormon fundamentalism were. And what they meant was, Warren Jeffs is a really terrible guy. I'm not going to argue with that. I think he's disgusting. I think the problem was, what we saw was an elision of Warren Jeffs with FLDS. And to some extent, that's fair, but the church is bigger than just this one guy or just the power structure. yes, I think people in power absolutely abuse that power. And I think men in power and women in power abuse that sexually a lot of times. So again, I'm not arguing that abuse didn't happen. There are, I think, 11 people who have been indicted for either underage or sex with minors or allowing or facilitating underage sex. So abuse was happening. My concern is the assumption that sexual difference necessarily equals danger, right? The assumption that all plural marriage, all polygamy has to be abusive, that there's no way for it to be loving and committed and just more complicated than we like to think of sex being.
Yes. I agree. it's really odd that as we're talking about it, and maybe this is what you're describing, Ben, where it's like, okay, this does sound like it matches the data that I know, but it doesn't sound right. It sounds like we should not be giving any slack, or, you know, it's like whenever you try and say, well, here's the context to the situation, sometimes people react saying, are you justifying this? Are you saying that it's okay?
Yep, I get that a lot.
So how do you deal with that? How do you wrestle with that charge that you're defending these awful people?
Yeah, I actually did a piece for Religion Dispatches about Kimmy Schmidt because I am obsessed. And this is my fault for reading the comments, but the comments and then the Facebook comments on having posted the article were all, you're stupid and you don't know anything about new religious movements and you clearly hate women and abuse does happen in new religions. And a woman, a former Christian scientist, actually emailed the dean of faculty at Bates to say that the subject line was ignoring the realities of sexism and sexual abuse in minority religions. So my response has been exactly what we're talking about here, to say, no, I acknowledge that abuse happens. What I want us to think about is which abuses to care about. And the abuses we seem to choose to care about are the ones happening in communities that we've already decided are suspect. We've already decided are wrong in some way, right?
Because we don't care about normal mainstream cultures or groups when they do the exact same thing, or we care about it less. Is the point you're making, right?
Yeah. Or we don't make their religion the causal element there, right? This is not to say that abuse doesn't happen in religious communities. It's to say that religion happens in all communities. Religion's not what causes the abuse. Larger systemic inequality causes the abuse, but that's harder to fit in a soundbite or a tweet, and so people don't want to listen to it, right? The role that religion does play, the sociological surveys are showing, is not that it causes the abuse. It gets used to justify the abuse, but lots of things get used to justify abuse. Religion's a complicating factor in leaving isolated groups, right? It can be much harder to leave a group that you have been affiliated with all your life for religious reasons. So there's some really interesting data saying that if we care about making sure that women in religious communities are safe, we need to think about not telling them that they're doing sex wrong, but making sure that if they want to leave, they can.
Well, that brings up another question that I had based on our conversation a few weeks ago. And I remember we talked about this the next day. So I wonder if we could go back into this and just kind of share some ideas. So one of the conversations that comes up sometimes amongst people interested in Mormon history and this sort of thing is when we think about the 19th century LDS polygamy, because there's some parallels then with FLDS polygamy as it was described in your presentation and such. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of two competing narratives, right? On one hand, there's a narrative of empowerment, that these polygamous relationships illustrate the freely chosen agency of women to participate in these relationships, and because they're freely giving consent, then that's a positive thing. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's a more negative narrative that consent is muddled in conditions and situations where we have strong religious authority. If you have someone that you believe to be speaking for God comes to you and says, you're free to do this or not do this, but just so you know, I received a revelation from God saying that we should get married and you should be my third, fourth, or fifth wife or whatever. Does that muddy the relationship or the possibility of exercising free consent in situations like this? So I'm curious, what's could you explain, like, what's your take on that? Where's the line between the freely given consent and coercion from strong religious authority? Or what's your take on that?
Yeah, I'm going to do the annoying theorist thing where I reframe the question, because yes, that obviously complicates things. But I'm not convinced that any woman in the 19th century or any woman in the 21st century makes a completely voluntary decision to get married, right? I think religion complicates it, but I also think it is massively complicated by a society that tells us that we need to be in a partnership with another person, and that women particularly need that kind of societal relationship in order to matter and to be considered as an adult. Or if we're talking about the 19th century, you know, to eat and have some place to live. So, yeah, I think religion complicates it, but I think reducing it to religion does a disservice to the complexity of the situation, right? If you're living in a situation where someone who speaks for God is telling you to do a thing, yes, that absolutely complicates your choice. But I don't know that it's the sole or even the most important factor. I don't know. I tend to focus more on the sort of big picture, what is the mainstream doing while these minority groups are operating piece. So when I think about 19th century polygamy, I want to look at like Sarah Berenger Gordon's response, where the United States uses sex to control, you know, the Utah Territory, right? We can drum up all of these acts of cultural distraction so that we can kind of get Utah in line. And the real concern is not establishing a theocracy, you know, and reasserting federalism. That's me.
Yeah, it does seem that in many of these situations, it's not so much a quote-unquote moral issue, but it's a political issue, and then the morals are used to argue it and persuade others to agree with whoever's fighting it in either direction.
Well, and this is where the time period for me gets interesting, because again, I work in the 1980s. So the coding of morality as Protestant sexual morality happens in the 1970s in really interesting ways, so that you get folks talking about morality in this broad, secularized way that's still deeply informed by Protestant sexual ethics, right? So the things that we assume are normal come from these kind of mainstream religious places, even when we're not necessarily aware of the religious roots of them.
So here's maybe a oddball question.
Okay.
Like, how do you realize you're a fish swimming in water? How do you get outside of your Protestant American culture and see how that's influencing your quote unquote secular views on morality? You know, how do you do that? It seems really hard to...
Clearly you major in religious studies, right? And you just do a bunch of reading. So there's some really great books thinking about the ways that American Protestantism informs American secularism. I mean, the first one that really stood out for me was Ann Pellegrini and Janet Jacobson's Love the Sin, where they look at the ways that Protestant morality really informed U.S. Supreme Court rulings on sexual freedoms, right? So the court system's interesting because it's supposed to be secular, but individual judges make these rulings, and individual judges have been influenced by a culture influenced by Protestantism, whether they're realizing it or not. Winnie Sullivan and her Impossibility of Religious Freedom makes this argument more broadly, not just sex, but any number of kind of religious practices. John Modern's got a book on how this operates in the antebellum America. Tracy Fessenden's Religion and Culture, Culture and Redemption, looks at the way that this operates in print culture. Sean McLeod did this with new religious movements in print in the 1940s, 1950s. So there are a lot of really great sources, but it's a little bit like The Matrix. And I hate to even use that analogy, because it also gets used to support men's rights activism. But the sort of once you've seen it, you can't unsee it thing. So starting to have the conversation, I think, helps you ask more questions and helps you be more aware of the assumptions underlying things that we assume are kind of neutral.
Yeah. I was just reading I'm in the middle of a book about the Equal Rights Act in Utah.
Interesting.
And they it was the International Year of Women,
mm-hmm.
and they were, it's this chapter talking about the organization of this conference they were going to have in Utah for the International Year of Women,
mm-hmm.
and they brought out at one point they brought out these objectives, I guess,
mm-hmm.
that were supposed to be hit, and like it was talking about things that to me had nothing to do with the Equal Rights Act or with the International Year of Women. Like it was talking about on April 21st, the committee held a public meeting at the state capitol to provide information about the conference and clarify the terms and policies set forth by the National Commission. The resolution subcommittee presented a list of preliminary resolutions they felt represented a consensus of women's views throughout the state.
Okay.
And one.
I'm so scared already. Okay.
So we reject any movement to eliminate from children's textbooks gender. This includes mother, father, miss, Mrs., man, woman. So they were really concerned about the Equal Rights Act making everyone unisex.
Right. So no gender neutrality.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this one I find strange. We wish to go forward to basic education concepts with math, American history, world history, free enterprise, economics, English, grammar, spelling, writing, and music back in the schools. We deplore the progressive education that is now present in our schools.
Speaking on behalf of all feminists, we're pretty okay with English and math and stuff. Yeah,
no, it just seems so strange, some of these things. Mm. We deny that there should be civil rights for homosexuals. These become special privileges. We affirm our approval of Anita Bryant's philosophy that our children should not be taught in public schools by homosexuals. And that's just... I could see that it's maybe, I don't know, tangentially or orthogonally.
Except that it's not, is the interesting thing. So it sounds like it would be tangential, right? It sounds like slippage between gender concerns and sexuality concerns. Mm-hmm. But one of the interesting things that you see in the 1980s is a folding in of sort of Catholic ways of thinking into this larger national sexual morality thing. And in classic Catholic theology, homosexuality is actually a gender disorder, right? You're doing gender wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not actually as much of a stepping away as it might initially sound. I mean, it's certainly, I think, not the way that we queer people like to think about gender and sexuality operating. But that's interesting, but not surprising to me.
Okay. Hmm.
I will say the ERA... In secular accounts about the LDS sort of response to the ERA,
mm-hmm.
I always sort of set my teeth on edge, and Krakauer does this as well, where it's hauled out as sort of an example of how backwards the church is.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously LDS had a role in sinking the ERA, but liberal secular authors love to do this thing where religious people are both stupid and sexist.
Yeah.
In a way that ignores all of the sort of liberal complicities in sexism. Makes me crazy. Like, obviously, only religious people are responsible for sexism. This isn't a larger problem.
If we just get rid of religions...
Exactly. Everything will be fine, right? There'll be no more sexism.
Yeah. There's a... Do you know Lindsay Hanson Park by chance?
I don't.
Okay. Yeah, she talks about this a lot, that a lot of people, they leave the church, they lose their faith or whatever... And they're still sexist and they're still racist.
Yeah.
Those parts of us that are inculcated subconsciously over years and years are really hard to dig out, I think.
Yeah, I think privilege and oppression are really pernicious. And this is exactly why I'm always concerned when we want to reduce inequality or abuse to religion. Religion is a cultural phenomenon. We make it every day when we participate in it, but we're not making it from scratch, right? We're making it from the materials we have, and the materials we have are racist and sexist and ageist and ableist and all of these other problems.
Mm-hmm.
So
that explains a lot of the world, I think.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Ben, in a couple articles,
people are the problem.
in a blog post that you just posted, you quoted, was it the American Grace book, where they mentioned that when it comes down to a choice, usually your political leanings will shift, will push your religious convictions.
Yeah, at least that was what the research in the book showed, is that when the two come into conflict, we would think, you know, one would think that if you had to pick between your political beliefs and your theological beliefs, that and they're in contradiction with one another, that you choose your religious beliefs over your political beliefs. But the authors of that study found that it was more often the case, although not always, but more often the case is the other way around, that people resolve the cognitive dissonance by siding with their political ideals and then changing their religious beliefs to match their political ideals rather than the reverse.
Yeah, it makes me wonder. We often think that these cosmic narratives, that these beliefs that are supposed to transcend the space between us and God, that are supposed to take us into the next life, that those are the most important beliefs. But it makes me think that perhaps our more immediate concerns that would be political or cultural are the ones that are the things that are actually driving our decisions. But then we animate those beliefs with our religious narratives to kind of mash the two together.
I want to push back a little bit about the idea that religion and politics is a dichotomy. The Kimball and Putnam book is a book that I struggle with for a lot of reasons, but mostly because it seems to imagine religious difference as this sort of deliciously neutral panoply of options. they use flavor, actually. And that, I think, undermines the material reality of violence inherent in minority religious identity. But in terms of the politics sort of v religion, I tend to be more on the Jason Bibbins side of things, where I don't think politics in the United States is ever absent religion. He actually uses the category of political religions. So I'm wondering if even the imagining of politics is sort of a thing guiding religion rather than politics as sort of imbued with religion already, is how I want to think about it. I'm going to think about that some more, but yeah.
Yeah, that would be a different epistemological assumption. Yeah. Based on the type of research done there, for sure.
But I will now plug Jason Bibbins' book, Religion of Fear.
There's also the point that, the ancient religious languages, Hebrew and Greek, don't actually have the word religion in them. That there was no difference between everyday life and religious life and political life, that it was all blended together. In the 18th and 19th centuries, there were a lot of historical narratives that were, I would say, concocted in order to force these two entities apart. Like, we often have this idea that science and religion have been battling each other since the beginning of time, and it wasn't until the Age of Reason that we were able to separate them. But in reality, a lot of the early scientists throughout the Middle Ages, and we often think of the Middle Ages as a dark time when it was really continuing to do whatever it was doing. It wasn't especially dark. But a lot of the scientists or thinkers, I guess would be better to say, a lot of the great thinkers that the Enlightenment scientists stood on top of were religious people. And a lot of the Enlightenment thinkers were still religious. There wasn't this mythical separation and discomfort of a scientist and a religion, a religionist being the same thing.
So I'm just going to keep assigning everyone homework. But right, this is J.C. Smith's argument, and religion is not a native category, right? Is that the things that we've come to code religion were not always separated out as something separate or special, if you want to use Ann Dave's terms, right? So religion is a category that was created in the West after the Enlightenment, and then we picked it up and took it other places while we were busy, you know, colonizing people and appropriating their resources.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things is, again, to make it all about American religions, is looking at the ways that cultures that don't necessarily have an internal category of religion have kind of used that politically. And I'm thinking here specifically of Tisa Wenger's work. She has a book called We Have a Religion, where she looks at early 20th century Pueblo, who used the category of religion to protect their right to do these sacred dances. And they tried any number of ways to say, look, this is an important thing. They argued for history, they argued for art, they argued for education, they argued for finance. And the only thing that stuck, the only argument that stuck, was that it was a religious practice. So the idea of religion not being internal to the way that the Pueblo necessarily thought about their lives, but they used it as the strategy of resistance to keep this practice alive. And then it sort of shifts the way that they continue to operate in the world. But yeah, religion's a slippery little bugger. It's really interesting.
And it's ironic, you mentioned this earlier, that all throughout United States history, there's religion invoked as an argument tool. Mm-hmm. And are we not the first state that establishes a purely secular government?
Did we though?
That's the thing. That's the thing. On the books, it's on the books, isn't it? It is secular, but in practice.
Well, so you get a lot of language. Sorry, I'm doing this American politics class right now. People argue for the separation of church and state.
Yeah.
A lot.
Disestablishment, right?
It's not even separation of religion and state, it's church and state. That language comes out of, Jefferson uses it, but the promulgation of that language comes out of concern about Catholics running things in the late 19th century. What we're actually guaranteed is that there won't be a state religion. We're guaranteed free exercise, but that actually means belief. And we're guaranteed that we don't have to take a test about religion to hold office. And that's really it. So how secular we actually are is up for debate. And even our idea of what secular is never happens outside of context of mainstream Protestantism. So we're just, it's turtles all the way down.
I've been doing this podcast once a month with Ben Park talking about these books in Mormon history. And we went through Kathleen Flake's book and Sarah Berenger Gordon's book and some others.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating and frustrating that the same arguments that were used against polygamy now, or sorry, we're not arguing polygamy now. The same arguments that were used against polygamy in the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century are the same ones that are used now against same-sex marriage, marriage equality. Oh,
very much so. So this is one of the things that I emphasize in my American Minority Religions class, is that the language of intolerance is very consistent, and it's particularly consistent around issues of sexual difference, right? There is this panic mongering about you do sex differently, and we have to freak out about it. And one of the things that's been interesting is in my research, the assumption that doing religion differently means you're doing sex differently and also wrong, which is a sexual difference absolutely happens, particularly in American new religious movements. But the assumption that bad sex equals bad religion and vice versa is something I'm really interested in, and it's very consistent historically.
So in addition to the example that we've been talking about with the FLDS community and such, what other, I guess, how can we apply the same framework to think about other pertinent things that are going on in America today, or things in the news, or things in religious news, or whatever? What sorts of narratives are out there that people are thinking about that your research would challenge or shed a different perspective on?
This is a really great question. So the book that I'm working on right now looks at what I'm calling a narrative of contraceptive nationalism, right? The way that we worry about minority religions members coming in and basically disrupting the sort of integrity of the body public, right? So one of the things that's been really interesting to watch is some of the interesting, heartbreaking, nauseating rhetoric around Islam, for example, as a sexual threat, right? And specifically as a sexual threat to white American women. The most outspoken, the most vocal, the most visible proponents of anti-Islam sentiment in the United States right now are overwhelmingly women. The Southern Poverty Law Center just did a really interesting piece on it. So your Pamela Gellers, those sort of people, are very specifically protecting themselves and protecting white womanhood from this imaginary Muslim masculine threat. So my project looks at Islam as this kind of imagined predator, and then also looks at the satanic panic in the 1980s, where we imagine the sort of anti-Christian other coming for our women and children. But one of the things that's been really interesting is that, again, this narrative is, it changes, but the notes are the same throughout American history. We get a lot of the same language about the Catholics in the 19th century. And some, again, when we're looking at the kind of the clergy abuse scandal. So the idea that religious others equals sexual threat, to the body public specifically is alarmingly consistent. But hey, at least now we know what to look for.
Wouldn't racial others fit that category as well?
I think absolutely. Part of the Islam piece of my project looks at the way that Islam becomes racialized. We think Muslims look a specific way, which is, you know, statistically ridiculous. Islam is a global religion. And one of the things in the chapter that I'm working on, I work on Not Without My Daughter. So Islam gets racialized as this Arab category, which is interesting. One, because her husband is Iranian, so not Arab. And two, because she lives in Detroit, right? The home of the Nation of Islam. And there's no mention that Islam is an American religion in that book. You'd think that there were no Muslims in Detroit, which is just ludicrous.
Hmm.
So yes, race is absolutely a piece here.
Yeah, I just remember in like The Black Rapist is a common trope.
But that doesn't get coded religiously, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was wondering. It seems a little, that's why I brought up the race thing. It seems somehow different, not necessarily. I don't know. Maybe I haven't read enough on this topic. Did they think of slaves as without religion?
So slaves get converted into Christianity forcibly, right? But slaves are also among the earliest Muslims in the United States, which is one of the reasons Islam is an American religion. It's been here since before there was an America.
Interesting.
But they're never, if you think Christianity in the United States, you're not often imagining people of color, right? Even though people of color are a huge part of Christianity in the United States. So Christianity gets coded white in the same way that Islam gets coded Arab, even though Muslims look like everybody because Muslims are everywhere.
Yeah, I served my mission in Cambodia and I met Muslims and that looked a lot like Cambodians.
Yeah, it's funny. We're there. It's funny though.
Another theme in this podcast, about once a month, we take questions from listeners. And it's called Ask the Mormon Sex Therapist. And we have this wonderful sex therapist named Jennifer Finlayson Fife, and she answers all these questions. And the theme comes up all the time that Mormons have an anxiety about sexuality, but not just Mormons. Americans have anxiety about sexuality.
Yes, and they do.
So what cultures are not anxious about sexuality, either historically or any contemporary cultures that you know of that are more not threatened, more comfortable with different practices or orientations?
So,
or have we found the universal frustration?
Well, no, it's tricky for the same reason that religion is tricky. Sex isn't that important until the end of the 19th century. It's obviously something that people have always done. It being the most important thing about who we are doesn't happen until psychoanalysis. We don't get that until the 19th century. The idea that who you want to have sex with and how you want to have sex is the actual truth of your being, is something that gets traced back to early psychoanalysis. And Freud does a lot with this. So the anxiety about sex, I suspect, as something significant about who you are, as opposed to just another kind of sin, is arguably unique to the 20th and 21st century. So history, have more history.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. So that makes me want to revisit views on the Puritans and that.
Oh, I love the Puritans. And the Puritans were surprisingly sex positive. They get a bad rap. The most gender egalitarian society on the continent, like on the continent we now live. 97% literacy. True story. Also, I always love this when we do arguments about traditional marriage. Puritans didn't do civil marriage or didn't do religious marriage because they thought it was a dirty civil contract and religion had no place in it.
Huh. We all That's do need awesome. To be a, like, everyone has to double major. And
religious something studies. Else in addition to religion, but there's a lot to know.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's really interesting. So, Megan, this has been lots of fun. This is such an interesting, and as we were warned, this is has some of it is challenging because it challenges our narratives in our mind and our assumptions about the world around us. So, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. This has been wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. This was
a lot of fun. Appreciate it, Megan.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, folks, I hope that was a fun, entertaining, informative podcast episode. I'll just give you one more reminder to go to the show notes, or if you already know where it is, go to Indiegogo and search for the Liahona Children's Foundation fundraiser that we're doing this year. Take some time, give of yourself, give what you can, support a Liahona Children's Foundation stake in Cambodia with us. As for next week, we have a couple different options. I may talk with Sheldon Greaves, the host of the Discovering the Old Testament podcast. I may talk with Ben Park and go over one of our books that we are overdue on. Or we may have an interview with Mitch Main and some other people. So you'll get one of those three. I'm not sure which one will be interviewed and produced in time, but you'll get one of those. So look forward to that. And until then, until next time, keep keeping it weird.